Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Tangential Banter. I'm Ben Mowell. As always, I'm here with my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
Ahoy there, y'all. No soundboard for the moment because I, yet again, am pinned down in my chair by a cat.
You have a feline board.
Yes. Meow, 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 meow.
I was going to say, if you poke Milo, does he make any noises?
Let me try. Nope.
Oh, sad.
I didn't poke him too forcefully, though. Normally, when I poke a cat, it's like in their squishy belly, but his squishy belly isn't exposed right now.
Yeah, it's probably all for the best. Otherwise, we might incentivize people to go around poking cats.
It's a good pastime. If you you do it right, you don't want to hurt them.
Just depends on the size of the cat and how confined they are.
How pokeable they are. What's the pokeable factor of this cat? 17.
We could take an approach like I did for the difficulty of a hole in one and rank cats based on their pokeability. Take into consideration factors like mass, length of claws, years of domestication.
Spiciness, as some people call it when they're not friendly.
Spiciness.
That's one spicy kitty, I've heard people say.
I have never heard that, but I get it.
Or it could be like a sort of Rockwell hardness test sort of thing. You do like a standardized, like, you know, force of poke and see how deep it goes into the material.
If we were going to go down that route, I'd rather use Brunel, though, I think, because it's a lower scale.
Oh, well, I mean, it'd be our own scale. It'd be the cat poking scale.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure like Brunel went. Well, how does Brunel differ from Rockwell?
So, okay, this is going to challenge me back to my material science class. But for the sake of the, I was going to say viewers, but the sake of the listeners, in material science, they measure the hardness of materials. There's primarily three different scales that can be used. There's a Brunel hardness number, and then there's a Rockwell B and a Rockwell C, I think, are the three. And from what I recall, the Brunel hardness tester uses a round indenter, like a spherical indenter. And then you measure the depth of the indentation, whereas the Rockwell methods use different sized diamond indenters and you measure the width of the indentation and then back calculate how hard the material is.
And they do the Brunel does it with us with a ball, just because the given stuff is so soft that if you use a diamond, it would pretty much always go all the way through, all the way in.
Yeah, so I think Brunel is used for testing the softest materials, and then Rockwell C is typically used for the hardest. So, I mean, we're still talking about things that we would consider to be very hard, like, you know, probably on the soft end would be something like copper or brass.
Right.
And the hard end would be titanium or something, you know? And I think the diamond shaped are also, I'm trying to remember what they're made of. I want to say they're also diamond. Maybe not. Not just diamond shaped, but diamond material.
Well, for the hardest of the scales, it would probably have to, because I'm sure you're certain to approach actual diamond, which is the hardest material known to man. Hard in the technical sense of what we're talking about. Or if you did this test on any material, then diamond would score the highest. And we haven't found anything that scores higher. And I find it funny too how Because, like, the way we quantify hardness isn't really all that scientific. Like, we can't really come up with a good, like, unit of measurement for hardness. Like, force, we can. Newtons and pounds, mass, like, grams and pounds, also pound mass, or slugs, technically. Distance, like, we can measure those. Hardness, we can't measure. What we can do is do this thing that Ben was talking about, this test, and then, like, we can determine this indenter went in this far on this material, but then it went in that far on that material. But, like, let's say it only went half as far in. Does that mean it's half as, or it's doubly hard? Well, not really. If I remember right, it's more nuanced than that. So there's not a good way to quantify how hard something is. But I think another, probably the, if this isn't the best because it doesn't give you numbers, but there's what's called the scratch test, I think, which is pretty unscientific, but you just take two materials and you basically just scratch them against one another. And the softer material, when you use it to scratch the harder material, won't leave a mark, but then the harder material will. So if you then you say, okay, material B was harder than material A, because B scratched A, but A didn't scratch B. Okay, you don't know how hard B is, you don't know how hard A is, but you do know that B is harder than A. And if you just do that with enough materials, like a list that's 100 long, you can get a good list of what's harder than what, but it still doesn't give you a number. Like, is the 50, you know that the 57th item in the list is harder than the 56th, but you don't know by how much. Another in
It's
another arena where science has failed us.
well, it's it connects back to our topic from the past several weeks of the limitations of science and being empirically derived rather than theoretical.
Right. This is a great example of that.
It's material science is very, a lot of the testing that's done is kind of interesting in that way. So you can do, oh, what's it called? The Charpy, like fracture test or something, where you actually swing this heavy metal pendulum against a thin test sample and see, you measure the rebound of the pendulum and then basically measure how much energy it takes to fracture the sample. And then there's a Jomini quench test to measure like how effective a heat treatment is of a material, how much harder it makes something. I'm probably butchering it, but that was a very interesting lab to go along with a class.
The Sharpie one, I remember. That one was pretty cool.
Yeah, you just lift up this big hammer and swing it against a
This
chunk of
teeny
metal.
tiny, like, the hammer is huge and this test sample is so small. It's like, this is unfair. I think it's going to get pulverized. But then it's like, you see how much of a beating that thing can take. It's like, that's impressive. Really quick aside, my material science class in college, you can take the lab and the lecture separately, which I did. I took them like 3 years apart from one another, because I think I was overbooked when I was taking the class. So I was like, all right, I'll just do the lab another time. And the professor for that class had been put on academic probation multiple times for failing too many of his kids. And this guy's the quintessential bad teacher, just doesn't care, doesn't know how to teach, is like, demeans you if you do poorly, like, said multiple times, like, I don't understand how you guys can't un like, I don't get how you guys don't understand this stuff. And it's like, dude, you're the teacher. Like, if every one of us is struggling to understand what you're teaching, maybe we aren't the problem, particularly if you see this pattern semester after semester.
And possibly also, he doesn't understand the material as well as he thinks if he can't teach it.
Well, I think he was only there because he was really good at it and like did research and stuff. It's the classic, like they keep professors on as professors, even though they're really bad at teaching, just because they want them there for other stuff, even though all the students are kind of getting ripped off. So then I ended up taking the lab again, like 3 years later, and had to remember a lot of this stuff. And it was, but it was pretty interesting. And by that point, because it was like the difference between being, I think it was like early sophomore versus late senior, like just the amount of depth and maturity I had made that lab really easy.
Interesting.
I also don't like how labs, so if anybody doesn't know, a lot of the, like, at least for engineering, and but I would assume for a lot of science related college major or degree plans, a lot of classes will have a lecture section and a lab section. And I would say anywhere between 50 to three quarters of your time are spent on the lab work, like doing lab reports or like the homework is related to what you do in the lab. But the lecture is usually worth like 3 credits, and the lab's like pretty consistently worth like one. And I never understood that.
What's also interesting, it just occurred to me that so science is all about discovery, right? And you use a standard method to learn new things. And yet we practice science as using a standard method to replicate someone else's results, not to be innovative or discover new things, right? Like every lab experiment, you're replicating some of the oldest, most standard tests in the industry. Like, what if we actually were pushing rather than just trying to have a simple test so we know if they got the right or wrong answer, or if we're actually using the labs to try and further science and actually teach students practical science, how they're going to be experiencing it rather than just repeating a known experiment.
Yeah,
Game changer.
I can see that because I think what college in general does, or school in general does, is just teaches you how to. It doesn't teach you how to think. It just teaches you what to think a lot of the time. And as like, so it teaches you like, yeah, like so in this in your example, I think it has some merit. Now, what I think also has some merit is let's teach you how to run an experiment and how to analyze data first before you start using those tools to do new stuff. Like it's hard to run an experiment to discover something new if you don't know how to run an experiment in the first place.
That's true.
And a good metric for do you know how to run an experiment is, okay, people who know what they're doing have ran this experiment before and got this result. Are you going to get the same result or is it going to be way different?
So in that case, then I think you'd be better off spending much more time on the design of the experiment and explaining how to do that effectively, rather than because in my experience, the lab was you're basically trying to match a known result. So you get credit if you're within some percentage of the standard answer, and you have to redo it if you don't. But
Yes. Yep, that was my I see what you're saying. Yes, I agree with that. That is a problem.
I think it'd be better if they talked about like, okay, how do you isolate a variable? Like, how do you know that you've actually controlled for potential errors or, random variation in your sample, all those kinds of things. More on the experimental design and statistical elements of it rather than just match this result, right?
Yeah, they maybe it's a good way to describe it as they teach you how to follow instructions, not how to think critically.
Right. Yeah. So you come out of it thinking, oh, science is like where I have a recipe and then I bake something using that recipe, right? And it's like, well, actually, in most cases, you have to figure out the recipe and then you write down what your recipe was so that other people can confirm they do get the same results. But then once a handful of people have confirmed it, it's not interesting anymore, right? You don't have people using that same recipe over and over and over again for the same to generate the same results.
Or then, like, to that point, I think to that point is, real science is, is coming up with the recipe in the first place, right? You made that point.
Right.
And a good, you know what a good example of another good example of that is when I was a kid, I loved building like Lego sets. Star Wars was like where it was at for me. And, you know, like anybody who's done Lego is, you'd say, oh, you know, the Republic gunship from the Clone Wars, right? Or the AT-AT walker from Empire Strikes Back, right? You get the kit and then you open the kit and you see all the different parts and there's in the instruction booklet, and the instruction booklet tells you step for step what piece to put where. And then you just follow that from step one to step 300 and then it's done. Now, if you did that and say, yay, this is really fun, I really like designing things, that's not designing things. That's following instructions. That's following that's just following a series of steps to show you how to assemble it. Designing it is a whole nother game. So I think the way that we do experiments in college is much more like, hey, here's your equipment. Here's the steps you need to do. Here's the result you should get. Go. What they don't teach you is, hey, you want to figure out what the yield strength of this material is, or, you know, the hardness of this material. How are you going to do that?
Right. Yep.
You want to build an AT-AT walker out of plastic. How are you going to do that? That's designing. Somebody at Lego figured out, like, here are all the parts we can use. Let's maybe get some customized ones. Okay, now how do we put it together? Okay, we figured out how to put it together. Now, how do we how do we come up with an assembly procedure step for step? It's one thing to know how all the pieces fit together. It's one more step towards complexity to know what order do they need to get put together in.
Right.
And then writing that down in a way where a six-year-old can understand it.
Right.
That's designing. You, as the 6 or 10-year-old putting the Lego set together, you're just an assembler.
Now, it's an exciting job assembling that, but it's still not designing.
Right. Now, I will credit Lego with fueling my creativity and want to design things. Because then what I would do is I would take all of the parts from all these different kits and I would deconstruct them. And then I would start making my own things out of the pieces. Now, were they as complex or pretty as the pre-made ones? No, but I would hope so. I would hope that a 10-year-old can't match a 30-something-year-old engineer, or maybe more accurately say that a 30-something-year-old engineer would have more competence than a 10-year-old that doesn't have an engineering degree. But, you know, I went from putting the pieces together as instructed to, I wonder if I can do this stuff on my own. And then I started doing that. And then here I am as an engineer.
What's ironic, and maybe not ironic at all, is that you just described the plot of the Lego movie, right? In which, what's the main character's name?
Oh, I can't remember.
Oh, I can picture his face. Chris Pratt did the voice. Anyway, the main character always follows the instructions, right? And then the other heroes of the story, or the protagonists that kind of join him, are these master builders who don't need instructions. They can visualize what needs to happen and build something without instructions. And then over the course of the film, main character moves from following instructions to building the double-decker couch that everybody hates. That becomes what hides That's them right. from Lord Business. And then he eventually becomes a master builder as well, where he can visualize it and doesn't need instructions. So
I forgot about the double-decker couch. They all give him so much grief for that. I'm like, come on, guys. It's not that bad of an idea.
Oh, man. That movie is amazing in so many ways. I remember going to watch it in the theater and just thinking, like, my friends and I used to make stop-action Lego movies when we were kids. And G.I. Joe, too. But we would have the same cheesy, like, you know, just vocal sound effects in the background and like these random nonsensical villains and stuff like that. And so when I went and saw it in the theater, it was like, this is literally the kind of thing we would have made if we had, you know, a $70 million budget or whatever it was to produce it, you know?
Yep. And I like how they made it look stop motion too.
Right. Yeah, just a little off kilter. Yeah. Shoot, I had another point I was going to make about that, but I forgot what it was. Yeah, I don't know. Not important. Anyway, that was a good tangent. We were talking about, what were we talking about?
I can't remember. I don't think we were about to get into what was supposed to be our opening topic.
It was poking the cat, and then we could have a method to quantify the pokeability of different cats, and then that became hardness testing, and then that became
material
labs.
Science and
Yeah.
Okay.
Going back to your comment about the professor who couldn't understand why you couldn't understand. I think being able to understand how and why people don't get a topic is a critical, if not the critical, criteria for being a good teacher. You have to be able to remember and sympathize with what it was like before you understood the material that you teach.
Mm.
And obviously you still teach it. You still understand where you want your students to get to, but you remember the process by which you gained that knowledge, and you remember the frustration or the challenge of not having the knowledge and having to kind of struggle through it to get to the point where you finally understood the topic. Mm. So I feel like hearing someone say that, if I were an employer in position of hiring or firing teachers, would be like, yeah, that's a problem. That's the fact that you don't understand how they don't understand indicates that you shouldn't be teaching.
Right. If only college worked that way, because he's not the only professor I had where it's like, this guy should not be teaching. He is not good at it.
It's unfortunately more than norm, I would say, than the exception, but I mean, it's not totally dissimilar in lower levels of education, right? There are some people who are really gifted teachers and find ways to make the material engaging and, personable and whatever. And there's other people who are just showing up and doing a job and doesn't seem like they really want to be there.
Alas.
But anyway, we now have a pivot into our primary topic for today. Which is something that popped into my mind maybe 2 weeks ago because of some conversations I'd had with different people over the past few months. And maybe I'll start with a specific example and then work backward into the general topic. But I was talking with a friend in Denver who is describing how she feels this tension in life that there are people who she, I believe, works with in this situation that she gets along really well with, enjoys spending time with, enjoys just building those relationships. But then she has all these people that she crosses paths with, whether it's through her, childcare or in the neighborhood or wherever else, other circles of life, that they're basically in her life, whether she wants them there or not. And she feels a sense of obligation to try to connect with them and build relationships with them. But then it comes at the expense of being able to spend time with these other people that she's trying to get to know in a deeper way. And so she was just talking about this tension of, why do I feel that way? Why do I feel like I'm obligated to spend time with all these different people when I don't really have the bandwidth in my life to do it? And my response to that was something that I'd shared with a few others over the past year or so, which is that I think that is a product of our modern society. So if you rewind the clock a few hundred years where people were living primarily in rural areas, primarily agricultural, the people who were in your social circle in your life, it was the same people that were your family and your neighbors were the people that you went to church with. They were the people that you ran into at the market. They were the people that if you went to school, you went to school with. Like, social circles were much, much smaller, and they were constrained by geography because they didn't have the amount of technology for keeping in touch across long distances. And so my argument is that my friend is feeling this tension because humanity over its history has not, there haven't been demands to keep in touch with so many people all at once, or even to see as many people as we do on a daily basis and be expected to maintain relationships with them. You know, maybe you would have relationships with your family, your neighbors, and some people at the market, and that was really all that you needed or had access to, right? You're talking about maybe a few dozen people. Whereas now, we just continue to accumulate people in our social circles that never leave our circles because of social media, right? So we at least stay on the fringes of each other's lives for years and years when we've never haven't seen each other in person in potentially decades, haven't interacted directly even through Messenger, you know, like instant message or phone for years. Like, it's like we knew each other at one point in time, and now we're just kind of people who are like, oh, I know the other person exists. But so between that effect and then the frenetic pace of our lives in our modern society, I think those two merge to create this pressure where we always feel like we have to be doing something, and then we know so many people, or we interact with so many people who belong to different social circles. So it's not like you can go, oh, I didn't see Jack at school, so I'll catch him at church or at soccer practice or whatever. It's like, well, I'm not going to see him until school tomorrow, right? And so you're basically you have to divide your attention against so among so many more people than we would have had to in years past. And so I think those two things really create the tension that my friend was feeling, and that's that whole scenario and premise led me to this thought that I don't think is a stretch, and probably a lot of people have already had it cross their mind, that humans as individuals and as a species weren't built to live in the modern world that we live in. And we can dive into all the different ways that that plays out, but I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on what I've said so far.
But my very first thought was at the very beginning, what you said, where you were describing your friend's predicament and saying, you know, there's people who I feel obligated to have, you know, spend time connecting with, but I really don't want to. And then my first reaction is then don't. There is no obligation. I mean, I don't know what sort of relationships are these that she was talking about? Is it like her mother or brother or sisters, or like what's the
No, I think in this situation, some of those individuals were like parents of other parents of children her children are friends with, right? So there's some level of having to communicate with people just because your kids hang out together. And then it's like, well, our kids are friends, so we should do stuff as a family or as families together so that our kids can hang out, right? So it's not as necessarily at an individual level feeling an obligation. It's kind of more because of the family structures at play.
damn, my first, my again, I'm still thinking like, don't feel obligated to hang out with people you don't want to hang out with. I know when I was a kid, my friends' parents like were friendly towards one another, but they never hung out. They never did. We never did stuff as a, we never did anything like family events, right? Where it was like the two families get together and hang out. If there was like a family event for one friend and they wanted to invite the other friend along, we would do that, but it would just be the other friend, not the friend in the family. That's a little weird to me.
But I think it's maybe different with younger kids, where it's like, okay, I'm going to take my kids to the park, and then you're going to bring your kids to the park, and their kids are going to hang out. So, like, now we're both here, so our kids can play together. And are we just going to ignore each other? Or am I now obligated to like carry on conversation and that kind of stuff?
I would say no. Go ahead and ignore them. Bring a book. Say, hey, I'm going to read this book.
I think you would be in the minority of parents to have that position.
Yeah, and I don't have a kid. Maybe if I were actually thrust into that scenario, I'd act differently. But
someday you're going to be in a park with your kids, and there's going to be a parent like, I'm going to go read my book. And you're like, wow, what a jerk.
No, I would respect that. But I mean, like the way you phrased her predicament also kind of got me a little irked. Not at her, but like this, it irked at the idea that she felt obligated to do all this stuff she didn't want to do. And it's like, look, people, like, we're going to be getting the impression that we're obligated to do a lot of stuff that we don't want to do in life. You have to say no. You have to just buck up, say, you know what, I don't want to do it, so I'm not going to. And if you're worried about what other people think, why? What is that going to, like, really, at the end of the day, what impact is that going to have on your life? There are so many times where once I kind of realized that, I was, oh, yeah, I guess I can say no, and there's nothing really that they can do about it. My life has become much more apathetic in a good way, where I'm not worrying about things I shouldn't worry about.
Like, but maybe that's at the cost of other things that you're not aware you're losing.
I guess, but if I'm not aware I'm losing them, like how big of an impact is that really making? And that's let me rephrase it this way. Yeah, I would agree with that. You have to, that's one of the things you have to weigh and judge when you're making those decisions. Is this something I'm willing to lose? And you don't always know what you're losing out on by rejecting a relationship like that, like what you're describing, or any other opportunity. But if you just, I think that gets back to, now you're just getting yourself flustered. If you really worry about that, and it's just one more thing that you're worrying about, which is the point that we're trying to address. I say take things at face value. If it's not something you're interested in, don't do it. And yeah, you might lose out on a cool opportunity, or you might have just saved yourself a whole lot of headache. And in fact, you know what? I think that latter scenario where you just saved yourself a lot of headache is going to happen more often than the other one. Because how often do we do things like join a club or start an activity just to regret it later? Or maybe not regret it, but where it just kind of falls by the wayside and nothing really comes out of it to the point where it's like, yeah, I could have lived without that.
Yeah.
You know, I would say that happens a lot more often than not. Maybe, and maybe I'm wrong, or maybe I'm the exception, but I've just learned to not be afraid to say no to things.
I think I would say both of us are probably pretty far on the willingness to say no spectrum compared to the average population. I think part of that being the pragmatic engineering bent, and part of that being a tendency toward introversion, being comfortable, like, no, I need time to just be by myself and not have to deal with people. So I think both of those factors would put us in a fairly high percentile of the population in terms of being willing to say no to that kind of a perceived obligation from others around us.
Yeah. Maybe a lot of people just have to grow a pair and just say no. I'm going to say it.
But a pair of what? A pair of
testicles.
Cheetos? Oh. So, okay. But my premise was still, going back to that, my premise is still that this problem would be far less noticeable in previous times because there are fewer relationships to manage and fewer activities to participate in. It was basically like everybody had to work all day, and you get home, and it's like, well, I'm going to eat and maybe do a little bit of some hobby and then go to bed, right? Like, so you didn't really have to worry about like, oh, I bumped into so and so in the market and we didn't get to hang out and maybe they're gonna be upset that we didn't spend enough time together or whatever, right? Like, I guess it could have still happened, but I feel like our priorities were elsewhere and there just wasn't nearly that volume of human interaction that we have. And I guess some of that could just be due to the size of the population in general as well. But I think part of it is how mobile we are, how interconnected we are. But that brings in some of the other things, some other normative facets of our current culture, which would be the prevalence of chemicals that influence our physiological state that are perfectly acceptable while others aren't. So things like sugar or caffeine that change or manipulate our energy levels. And being able to take those at high concentrations repetitively in ways that, people a few hundred years ago weren't able to do to that degree. And then, the whole another way that we manipulate chemicals in terms of like dopamine hits, right? With binging streaming services or, just clicking through your social media, the doom scrolling and looking for, oh, who liked my post or whatever, all those things that we're starting to see studied now. I think add into that whole, like our brains just aren't equipped to deal with that, I guess is what I, the way I would frame it.
And the things you said make me think that we've tried so hard to make things easy on ourselves and we've succeeded. And now it's really easy and really quick to get a lot of good stuff and then to the point where it's excessive and our bodies can't handle it. Like that's why there's addiction to social media and, well, I'm not sure, sugar related, right? Sugar's everywhere. Sugar wasn't, I don't think, very easily obtained back, just a few hundred years ago, or even a couple hundred years ago. But now it's everywhere. Now it's in everything and in gratuitous amounts. And we do that because, hey, it's really good. We like it. We want more of it. So let's get more of it. We did. And then that process just re kind of, rinse and repeat it to the point where you can down like, three cans of pop a day, and each one has like 50 grams of sugar in it.
And caffeine. And then you run around spraying your grandma with a hose saying, I'm all hopped up on Mountain Dew.
That's right. Good old Talladega Nights reference there.
Yeah, I think it's like we have very refined, well, I'll say very refined. We have very powerful levers to counteract effects that we don't want, but then we are not equipped to handle the consequences of those levers, right? It's almost like we have a jackhammer and we
Hey, that
see
sounds
a
like me.
it does. We have a U-hammer and we see a fly on the concrete, and so we're like, oh, I'm gonna crush this fly. And it's like, well, yeah, you're jackhammer really crushed that fly, but it's also creating cracks in your concrete, Like it's such a powerful tool. It has ripple effects that we I think we understand scientifically, like we're starting to wrap our arms around how big some of these problems are, but we can't like rationalize it at an individual level very effectively of like, oh, this behavior is actually having very negative effects on me in other ways, side effects that I don't notice as much, right? But are long term, we're going to be very problematic.
Well, some of those side effects, if they're just physiological, are hard to pick up on. Right, it's not like you have a gaping wound. It's not like you look at Facebook a little too long and then you start bleeding excessively from your ears or something. Oh,
Right.
there's my cue. I'm done. That's enough.
You just start drooling a little bit more, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of it is a cumulative effect over just unending exposure. And then there's so many of these that are going back to our experiment design conversation earlier. There's so many of these that are confounding factors that it's hard to isolate, right? Where it's like if you're exposed to all of them all the time, how do you determine which ones are really having the negative effect?
Right. So what so you meant like the social media thing and addiction to a lot of the like easy access stuff. I'm trying to think other ways that humans I think like somebody brought up a point on Facebook or something one time, somewhere on the interwebs. Keyboard philosopher and whatnot. But they said, it's like, we used to work so much back in the day, on the farm and such. And we came up with all this technology and we're still working a lot. Like, what's the deal? Like, shouldn't we at this point have be having robots do everything for us? Like, why are we still working like, 8 hours a day, which is less, 8 hours a day for 5 days a week is less than I would think your average work week would have been, in the 1500s. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But it still seems like there should have been a bigger improvement now, given how much technology we have. And that's re somewhat related. That was sort of a tangential point. But the point I'm trying to make is, it seems like all of our technology has only put a heavier burden on us than lightening the burden. Or, what I think's really happening is technology is lightening our burden of work and survival, or just survival in general. But then we don't take the opportunity to say, hey, I don't have to work 4 days, 4 hours a day to get food for one day, right? I can go to the grocery store for an hour, be back in an hour and have a week's worth of food. That's 1 hour for 7 days versus 4 hours for one day. That's great. But what do you do with that extra time? You fill it with other stuff, like working out, or maybe you're spending more time at work, or well, now I'll go join this club or this activity that starts to feel like an obligation and something that I may not enjoy as much as I thought. And it just sort of, it like, we just end up loading, like, all of technology has made our plate bigger so that it's not as crowded anymore, but now we just crowd it with more stuff, which is still good, I guess. But I think people just tend to not rest as often as they should, and that can lead to problems.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It makes me think of two things. The first one being, I think the primary impact of technology has been transforming the nature of the work that we do. It's not necessarily I mean, we do work less time, but it's primarily taking the physical element out of our labor in a lot of ways. So now, somebody who used to do 16 hours a day of physical labor, to farm their fields, for example, could now spend 16 hours riding in a tractor that does most of that work for them, and all they got to do is press some buttons, right, and steer periodically. And it not only provides food for them, but it provides food for hundreds of people. So, I
Well,
think.
hold on, let me stop there. But that would mean that the hundreds of other people that are now getting their food supplied by this farmer now no longer have to farm their own food. So yeah, that one guy may not be working any less, and it's just the work he's doing is not as physically hard. But by him doing that, now all these other people don't have to do the work at all.
Right. Yes, absolutely. But so we now have institutions, systems, technology that never existed before, right? So there's now how many thousands of people employed in the design, development, manufacture of microchips and smartphones that we never had to do that before, right? So there's a new type of work that has emerged to replace work that has been replaced by mechanization in some ways. So having all these people with free time, they go, oh, what am I going to do with my time? They find other things to work on. And those things, I would say, tend to be less manual and more mental, right? We're solving problems, we're using computers, all those kinds of things, not necessarily going, well, I don't have to farm anymore, so I guess I'll go dig holes or something. But the other, so the other point was... Sorry, total brain dump here.
Is it brain dump when your brain takes a dump, or when you poop out your brain? So it's like a brain dump.
I mean, some people, the most common usage I hear of brain dump is like when you're quote unquote downloading your knowledge to somebody else as quickly as possible. Like during a job transition or something, you're trying to get someone up to speed, you brain dump and pass along all your information. But in this case, I used it to be the equivalent of like a brain fart, where it's just completely not processing any information at the moment. Because you talked about we're working less, and there was a second piece that you said, and I was trying to respond to that, and I forgot what your point was.
Working less, you fill it with more stuff.
Okay, so you were talking about how we have a bigger plate, and then the stuff we put on our plate gets kind of expands. So I think this is true in a lot of elements of our lives, and I'll put it this way, is that humans are incredible adapters. And so in the work sphere, if we're working less, we find other things to fill our time with. And so we end up equally busy, even if our time is spent differently than it was before. So if we were working 16 hours a day before, now we're doing stuff for 16 hours a day. We're not just sitting, but maybe it's less strenuous. It's not necessary for survival, so on and so on. But I think that same core element of us becoming adapted to our changing circumstances rapidly, it really can mess us up in different areas where I would argue this is something that we see in mental health, because mental health has become a significant issue. And I think what's happened over time is that we have fewer and fewer external threats, like physical threats and even like existential threats, I guess. And so we've started to internalize those threats in a sense. And so now we perceive threats that aren't there, like our brain essentially manufactures threats that it doesn't need because it has space to have threats, right? Like if you're not worried about being eaten by a lion, your brain still has that worry capacity. And so it worries about something that it doesn't need to be worried about.
Well, let me stop you there really quick. Would it be more accurate to say that our brains are so maybe trained to identify and worry about threats that if you remove the threats, it's so trained to identify threats and start misidentifying stuff as a threat?
Yeah, I think that, so there's, I'd say at least two components. What you described is one, and then I would say that the pattern or the method repeats no matter how safe your environment is, right? So there'll always be something that's a little bit more threatening than the rest of your environment. And so that danger detection algorithm in your brain hones in on that one thing that's not like the others and says, that's a threat, right? Even if it's like cotton balls, you know, whereas
burn them all.
You used to be surrounded by knives and you got rid of all the knives, and now you're surrounded by cotton balls and you're like, well, but I could swallow one of those. So now I got to replace them with, you know, something even softer that I can't swallow. And then it's it's pillows, right? And then it's your brain just keeps going through this cycle. And I've thought about that with myself in terms of how do I balance, you know, we were talking about earlier about saying no sometimes. And it's the question I've asked myself is how do I balance what I want to do or what you could say is quote unquote, like self-care versus where do I need to push myself so that I don't just become weaker in any given area over time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because if you only ever do the quote unquote self-care thing, you end up doing nothing, knowing nothing, achieving nothing. Right.
Right.
You're always avoiding something that could cause you harm. And so you become less harm tolerant. And there's actually a lot of interesting studies and stuff that have been done and are being done on that topic. But I don't think that's something we as a society have really brought out into the open yet as a topic of conversation. I think we're still trying to make everything easier, simpler, nicer, whatever. And that ultimately erodes our capability to be resilient and to adapt to difficult situations.
Is this so, like, I've heard the adage, right, that you know back in my day, if something broke, we fixed it, we didn't just throw it away. Is that sort of what is that a related thing to what you're talking about, where we're so used to being able to get what we want because it's so easy to get what we want that as soon as we face adversity, we aren't equipped to deal with it?
To like your last,
if you're so used to being able to just, you know, like, oh, this is not as good as it used to be, I'm just going to replace it, and you're that's just how your life has been, you're going to take the mindset of, well, I'm not going to bother fixing this, I'm just going to get a new one. And that it's therefore, yeah, it's trained us to not fix things. And is that sort of a related phenomenon to what you're talking about, where we're so used to getting things easily that as soon as we face any sort of obstacle, we're so soft at handling it?
Yeah, I think it certainly could be, right? Because there used to be, and you can see it. I shouldn't say used to be. I think each successive generation takes pride in being self-reliant in different ways, right? But in your example, if it's, you know, let's say I'm going to go mend a fence or whatever, right? There was a pride in having the knowledge and the skill to be able to repair something yourself, so that you didn't have to go buy something new, right? Because that was money you couldn't afford to spend, whatever. And now our standard of living is high enough and life is easy enough. It's like, well, what's easier? I mean, I could probably look it up on YouTube and figure out how to repair it and go buy the parts or whatever, or I could just hire somebody and have them come repair it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a blend of our the means that we have to acquire things that we want, as well as, yeah, just an expectation of ease, and that we'll take the easiest path, even if it's at, you know, higher cost or whatever. Whereas people in the past would have probably in many cases preferred the harder path because they could do it themselves.
Well, remember, part of the cost is the cost of time and inconvenience/effort. You know,
absolutely.
Spending time doing something you don't want to do, right? That's part of the cost. Yeah, it'll save me money if I do it myself, but I know how much money it's going to cost to not do it myself, and I think that that money is worth the effort and inconvenience.
Yeah, and maybe that's just a result of having a more, how would I describe it? An economy with a higher rate of exchange of goods and services.
I know what you mean, right? If you have like a let me step in. If you have like a population of 5 people, right? The odds of that population of 5 people having a proficient plumber, lawyer, doctor, architect, lawn service guru, interior designer, you know, all of these services, right? The odds that that small population is going to have all those things, not going to happen. But if you have a really big population, there's a higher chance that all that stuff, that there is somebody who's the go-to person for any individual niche.
Right. And the fact that, yeah, so you've got higher density populations, which means there's the probability of there being an expert in that field is much higher. Their availability is better because, you know, transportation doesn't take as long. So they're not wasting half their time just getting to where they're going. Right. In your example, in a population of five, it's like, okay, I don't want you to be a plumber or a carpenter, or whatever. Those are relatively simple skills that I know I could handle if I needed to. I would rather that you go be a doctor so that, you know, when I get shot, I've got somebody who can patch me up, right? Like a truly essential skill.
You probably won't need a crime scene investigator because if there's only five people, it'll probably be pretty easy to figure out who did it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think in that way, a lot of people were maybe more reluctant to hire something done or buy something done because it was like, I want to save the resources that I have for something that I truly have no ability to do myself. Mm-hmm. And now you can, that threshold I think is much lower. Like a lot of those types of services are more accessible perhaps than they used to be. Unless you need a cobbler and then it's like they don't exist anymore.
Or a cooper, right? How many people just know how to whip you up a barrel? Now, you know, not a lot of people.
Not a lot of people. That's true. And those dang dwarves ruined all my barrels. You know, I was trying to send them back and get some more wine, and then the freaking dwarves.
Alas. And I don't want it to, at least I'm not saying that all of these conveniences are bad and we should get rid of them. But I think, and I'm guessing this was your original point, all of these good things that society and technology is developing, as good as they are, they have some unintended consequences or unforeseen consequences that if we just keep ignoring them, it's probably going to lead to problems.
Yeah, I think it has led to problems would be one statement. But another one is we only ever deal with these things in hindsight, right? Like we don't do a very good job of steering our society in the direction we want it to go. It more gets steered as technology develops. And then we react to that and say, oh, we like that or we don't like that. Now let's adjust. But so we do a really kind of crap job of being, you know, there's that meme from, or the line from Jurassic Park that's become a meme where he says they were so busy, he's talking about the scientists, they were so busy figuring out if they could, they didn't think about if they should.
Right.
Right. And I think that's kind of been the history of humans' relationship with technology is we're just like, can we, how do we do it? And not like, well, should I do that? And I think we're having that conversation is actually starting to come up now as we're really AI is accelerating and everything is like, well, should we be doing this? Right. Or how do we apply it in ethical ways and not just ethical, but like in ways that aren't going to completely like have massive unintended side effects on the way that we live our lives.
Mm-hmm. AI is a good example of what you were bringing up earlier, where if it just can basically do critical thinking for us, then people are going to stop thinking critically because something else can just do it for them. And that's the easier way. And then when they need to critically think about something, they're not going to be able to do it.
I think in that regard, a lot of scientists, mathematicians, et cetera, philosophers generations ago were probably more capable at a individual level than most of us are today, right? We've benefited from their work and we now have tools that can improve upon it and build on it, but we might not be capable if we were to be set in a vacuum to recreate what they did because we become so dependent on those tools.
And when you say we, because obviously if we compare the general population of today to like the renowned, like famous people, the people who were so good and so unique that their names have stuck with us for centuries. But it seems like a bit unfair of a comparison because you could do the same thing and say, oh, I bet nobody in fi the 1500s were as good as Albert Einstein or Stephen Hawking or, you know. Like, well, of course, because you're comparing
That's
apples and
true.
oranges in both cases. But I think your point is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the people back then, because they didn't have as many crutches as we did today, were much more self, that's what I'm looking for, able to do things on their own power than people of today. People of maybe similar intellect or position. Right, if you had somebody who is as good as Leonard Euler in what he was doing, that person today would be so used to having crutches that he would fall behind Leonard Euler if you were like sent back in time or something to Leonard
Yeah,
Euler.
I kind of think of it of like if you took someone who lived in I don't know, let's just say the 1300s, brought them to the modern world, there would be a massive amount of culture shock, but their ability to survive, maybe I'm oversimplifying, but they would have to learn how to navigate society to survive. And one of us going backward would have to learn a whole bunch of survival skills and just how to work your butt off all day, every day to survive, right? Like it's a totally different set of skills that are required to live in the two different scenarios. And so as we built up all these tools and processes to make our lives easier, we have across the vast swath of the population completely lost the ability to survive in the world that our ancestors did.
Sure, like 90% of the population, if they had to go, like, you know, acquire their own food, like if you send them back and say, okay, you're living in the 1300s, like you have to go get your own food, it's like they would die. Or they'd have to really mooch off of people for a long time. Or maybe not a long time, but, you know, they wouldn't be able to survive on their own. They'd have to rely on other people. However, if you took somebody from the 1300s to today, and said, okay, good luck. Where are they gonna, like, ooh, you know what? Let's think about this experiment for a second. Are we set? So whether we're sending somebody from the past into modern times or somebody from modern times into the past, are we setting them up with like a family or something where it's like these are the people that you're gonna be working with? Because if you literally just take somebody, you don't even have to change time zones, just take somebody. Strip everything that he owns, put him like, you know, I could do that and bring you to Russia, Ben, today, or China and say, good luck. You know, you're gonna have a tough time. You have no connections, you have no money, you have no, in the case of China, no communication skills. You know, what are you gonna do? How would you survive? How would you get food, you know, in the next few hours? If I just dropped you off in
Which
China right now.
the same couldn't necessarily be said of previous times, right? Because it's like you already had methods for figuring out what's edible and what's not. You already knew how to hunt, you knew how to build shelter, you knew. Et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yeah. So I would agree, but that's the thing, right? If I drop you into a city, then those skills aren't going to help you because you can't go and kill somebody's dog for food.
I mean, you
You
can't. It's frowned upon.
just frowned upon. Hey, you shouldn't have done that. I like that
We
dog.
don't take too kindly to strangers eating dogs around here.
But I mean, like there's I the point I'm trying to make is I think if you were to take somebody from the past and bring them to the future, they would actually, I think, have a hard time to survive because you can't just make shelter wherever you want. You're going to get pulled over by the police. You can't just start killing animals and eat it. Like if even if today, right, if you were to if somebody from the 1300s were plopped in suburbia and say, okay, good luck. You know, they don't speak English. They'd have to start hunting squirrels and birds. Well, where are they going to cook it? There's no place they can start a fire to cook it without getting arrested. Yeah. Unless they go to a park or something, but they would have to identify that that's a safe place to do it. And they're not going to have the means to do that. And like, what about a job? They have no skills or very little skills that they'd be able to use in today's culture to get a job, to get money.
That's true. Yeah.
And like, you know, they're like where are they going to grow their own food? There's no public land, or they wouldn't own any land to grow stuff on. So that's why I'm wondering, is it better to conduct this experiment with, there's a family that we're going to teleport you to and they're going to take care of you, but all they're going to do for you is just make sure that you don't die. They're going to give you like a ration of food. They're going to give you a place to sleep. So that way it's not like you just get dropped off and, oh, you don't speak the language. You're not accustomed to how they get food. You're going to die within 3 days. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of how to frame up this thought.
Somebody from the 1300s is not going to know how to fill out a job application. Somebody from the 1300s is not going to know how to open a bank account or apply for a debit card or a credit card. They're not going to understand cash. That's how our society works. So they would, I think, actually struggle.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm getting at is like, okay, let's say that tomorrow some solar flare, EMP burst, completely wrecked all of our electrical grid and internet communication, whatever. So we're like reverted back to the 1300s, like we're talking about.
As far as technology, right?
As far as technology, yeah.
Okay.
We would have a far harder time surviving in that scenario. There'd be massive starvation and deaths, right? Versus somebody from that age who's going to be like, oh, it's just another day, right? We didn't have electricity before. We don't have electricity now. So like, we have inherent tools in our culture, like that we are 100% dependent on for us to continue surviving in the way that we do. And not just the way that we do, but surviving in some cases at all. Right. Like if we didn't have electricity, communication, if internal combustion engines weren't working, the global population would plummet rapidly. Right. Mm-hmm. Because we wouldn't be able to provide food for all the people that there are.
Mm-hmm. Certainly so not. Like, not quick enough to the point where we wouldn't have starvation. So you're talking about survival skills in the wilderness.
Essentially, yeah. Like we've lost, as we've adopted more and more technology, we've lost the ability to care for ourselves or to survive on our own, right? Survival now, you're completely dependent on people around you, whether, you know, through an employer, through a doctor, through the grocery store clerk. Mm-hmm. Your survival is dependent on everyone playing their part.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And yeah, before it wasn't that way.
Yeah, I would agree. But I that is a vulnerability that society in general today has, because you're right. If like a solar flare came and wiped out the electrical grid, that's going to be a big problem. So I think that's the cost. That risk is part of the cost to being dependent on technology. But of course, the upside is that we can support all of these people. We can get 1 week's worth of food in an hour versus, you know, over like working 30 hours a week just to eat.
Right. Right. Yeah. My point only was that, I'm certainly not saying it's a bad thing. It's just that as technology enables, it also creates dependency, right? So you can't really unwind the technology clock without erasing a whole swath of humanity in the process.
Right. And I would agree with that.
So it's, we're kind of joined at the hip now as a species to sustain our current levels of population.
But maybe it's a more interesting conversation, and I think this gets more to what we were originally talking about is, sure, I think everybody understands that if the electrical grid goes down, we're in trouble, right? And that vulnerability, that risk is something that we are inherent that we have now, and it wasn't back in the day. But what are some of the other wait, we actually talked about this one time, the unintended consequences of technology. Yeah, we did, already had a topic on that. Wow, we're just circling right back to the tangent, eh?
And we also talked about how young you'd have to be to survive on your own.
That's right. So what I'm trying to think is the topic we were originally discussing today, or not originally, but we're discussing today, was a bit it was different than those, and it was like, what's the oh yeah, how humans aren't designed for the modern world. So the point I'm trying, so I guess, yeah, let me rephrase what I just said. More suited for that question. By making it easier for us to get food or to go from point A to point B, how does that clash with how the human body or brain works that might have unintended consequences?
Yeah, I think it's actually, we've talked about several of the factors already, which is that when we're built or wired to have a smaller social circle, to do a lot of physical work, to, take care of ourselves, that means that having a lot of relationships that we have to manage is stressful, right? Like that's not something that we're built to do is to manage a whole bunch of relationships. Communicating or trying to keep in touch across long distances or long periods of time is not something that we're really built to do effectively. Sitting down and being idle or resting is not something that we do by default. And so all those types of behaviors now find either create stress or they find a new home and maybe things that they could be good or they could be bad. But yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of that conversation about the like lizard brain people talk about or the like what's your kind of default operating mode. And I think our I think we've maybe talked about in previous episodes, but just the pace of change in our of technology and of our society, I think is something that causes immense stress, like subconscious stress on us as people, that potentially leads to health issues and mental health issues and all sorts of different things that we're not aware of, right? But change is one of the biggest sources of stress and fear, in life. And so that wasn't, change wasn't something that our ancestors would have had to deal with to nearly the extent that we do today. And I
Yeah.
swear we've had this conversation before, but maybe it was offline.
So you raise a we it's not sounding too familiar to me. It may have been with our, the unintended consequences of technology discussion, but I mean that does tie into like that was more what are they, but now we're seeing maybe like why is that the case, right? And I you think you raised some good points where like we're much more sedentary. Which means that you're not, which one means that you're not moving, which one means that you're made out of silt.
Sedentary means that you don't move,
Sedentary.
and wow, I can't even think of the other word.
It's really similar, right?
Yes. I'm resisting the urge to look it up.
Yeah, it's not just the same word, is it? Sedentary and sedentary. Sedentary? Is there an extra
Sent
sed?
it's there's and then there's sentiments, things that you feel.
Sedentary lake, maybe. Sedentary. You know what I'm trying to say? People are much less moving than
Roads, roots.
roods. people move around and physically exert themselves a lot less. And that was part of the point of technology. But now that leads to health problems. People like their socials. Go ahead.
So it's like silt would be sediment, right? Like sediment, sediment. And then sedentary is not moving. So
sedentary versus sedimentary.
Yeah, sedimentary. Yeah.
Sedimentary. Okay. Because there's, I know in Minnesota, there's glacial lakes and sedimentary lakes. I think I'm saying that right.
So it's, sedimentary and sedentary.
Yeah.
And sentiments.
Yes. Sentiment.
Anyway.
Yeah.
It finally occurred to me. So continue.
The abs, no, excess, not abscess, woof. The excess of social interactions. We've already talked about. Then there's the sedentary lifestyle that's made possible by technology, leads to health problems. And one thing I was talking about earlier, which I think humans, because we have so much more time for stuff during the day, we pack our schedules full. So now we're just really, really busy all the time, going from A to B to C to D. And I think that also our brains aren't designed for. To the point where just having, even if you're spending as much time being engaged, I'll put it, and then maybe not physically active, but engaged in one, like either at work or in an after work hangout or stuff that you want to actively say, I got to get to this, I got to go to that, I got to get working on this. Having your day packed with that, I think takes its toll. And I think that would probably take a different, and perhaps, it would take a different toll than if you're just working on a farm for 16 hours a day. You know, keeping track of like a really tight schedule, I think, is not something that we are very well equipped to do. And that has its consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've talked about this recently with some coworkers. The cognitive load of managing many tasks, even if they take up the same amount of time as one task. Right.
Yeah.
So like the person plowing a field for 12 hours a day mentally has a lot less load than somebody who has to do 12 1-hour tasks over the course of the day. Right. Mm. And like plan when they're going to, what order they're going to happen in, keep track of if they're ahead or behind schedule, you know, drop something to go do something else and then come back to it later. Like, it's not just more cognitive load. It's also so much less efficient because you're starting and stopping tasks all the time, right? You're never actually in the groove of something. You're constantly in the process of starting something or stopping something. And, you know, you're might have tools or equipment that you're using that you have to put away and then get back out. And so the amount of dedicated time and attention that we can give to any one thing in our lives has to be a tiny fraction of what it used to be.
Yep.
Because we just don't have the time available. We've dedicated it to these other things. And it's like, wow, where'd the day go? Right. Well, it was mostly spent switching between a bunch of activities.
And the point of this back and forth, right, is that the modern world encourages that because as it frees up time, everybody's not just going to sit around doing nothing. They want to say, hey, now I have time to do X, Y, and Z. And that involves other people, brings them in. And eventually everybody's schedule is just packed with a bunch of smaller stuff. And now managing all that stuff is kind of rearing it, the side effects of that are rearing its ugly head with mental stress and mental and emotional problems.
And I think along with that is somewhat our ability to keep accurate and universal time, right? Where maybe in the past you would have said, oh, I'll come over once I finish the fence. Now we say it's so it's task-based or it was kind of more aligned with the rhythm of life. Now we say I'll come over at 2. And then if we haven't finished the fence, we're like, well, I'll finish it later, right? And because we want to keep the 2 o'clock appointment.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are now operating, I'll say it this way. I think before we had a lot of the ubiquity of a universal time, life operated far more on a biological rhythm or an organic rhythm that just kind of fit what you needed to get done. And now we fit what we need to get done into this mechanical rhythm of hours and minutes and seconds, right? And that we try to package what we need to get done into these bins that fit neatly in this rigid schedule. So all of that to say, again, we certainly reap many rewards of that trade. I think where the challenge comes in is that it's not one that we made intentionally up front or knowingly necessarily. We only see the cost of the trade in hindsight. And so I think as a society, we would be well served if we did if we took the time to reflect on what's changed and the impacts that it's had and where it's maybe not as good or helpful as what we'd hope for. And maybe make intentional decisions to be different because of that.
And perhaps this gets to, was it last week's conversation of, no, two episodes ago of like, why couldn't we predict this? Why do we have to rely on finding out about this stuff in retrospect? Don't we understand, you know, how humans are going to react to this stuff?
Yeah.
And if not, why not? Like, if the one thing that we understand, like, we can't understand anything better than we understand ourselves. So if we can't even predict how we're going to react.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of it is predictable, right? We just don't ever put the time into predicting it in advance. But maybe that's easy to say because we can now see the results. And so it's, well, of course we should have known that in advance. We just didn't, right?
Indeed.
But if you listeners out there have any examples where you can think of situations that we as a society have intentionally or predictively avoided something or changed a behavior because we didn't want the consequences, maybe that would be an interesting topic for the future, but certainly I'd like to hear any examples that you have in mind or other examples of ways that we are not well suited for the modern world in which we find ourselves. So if you have any thoughts on those, we'd love to hear from you. Again, you can always sign up to be a guest in a future podcast. We are actively working on getting two guests lined up, hopefully in the near future here, trying to work out schedules, but hoping to have a couple more guests before the summer is up in some upcoming podcast episodes. So thanks for joining us today. And until next time, take care.